Yeah, we talk a lot about apologetics, which means giving different reasons to defend Christianity. What I've come to be persuaded of is that the Bible has an apologetic of its own. So apologia is the Greek word for defense. And as Luke lays out this last section of Acts, he is giving an apology, a defense of Christianity.
How do you work with other Bible teachers to put together an effective and faithful teaching series? This is the question we put to George DeWalker today as we discussed a recent sermon he's preached in Acts chapter 19, the story of the riot in Ephesus. You can listen to that sermon on our channel wherever you listen to the Bible Matters podcast. George is a pastor at St. Helens Bishopsgate in London, ministering to their evening congregation, as well as training the church's apprentices.
But we were also joined today by William Taylor, senior pastor of St. Helens Bishopsgate, and Tim Shepherd, who leads the student ministry there as well. Both Tim and William preached sermons in the same series in Acts, and so we asked the three of them how they worked together to craft a coherent series and enabled their talks to complement each other. My name's Tiff Stromso.
And my name's Leo Elborn. And this is the Bible Matters podcast, encouraging faithful Bible teaching and ministry. Well, it's a real privilege to be here today with George DeWalker, curate at St. Helens Bishopsgate and the preacher of the sermon in Acts 19, verse 21 to 41. George, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We're also really, really lucky that today it's not just George joining us, but we're joined with William Taylor, the rector of St. Helens Bishopsgate.
Lovely to be here.
And also Tim Shepherd, who works at St. Helens Bishopsgate amongst the students.
Thanks for inviting me as well.
And the reason we've got William and Tim is because they also preached in the Book of Acts in this same series. It's really, really great to be with all of you, and we're really looking forward to speaking to you.
George, can we kick things off with you? Can you tell us about when you were first convinced that the gospel is defendable?
Well, I think I've always thought the gospel was defendable. When I was at school, my nickname was the Reverend because I was that child who, I was that student who in the sixth form centre would be arguing with everyone about whether God existed and whether it was reasonable to be a Christian. I suppose what's changed in my understanding of the defendability of the gospel is how you go about defending it best. Probably then I thought it was arguing and having lots of cogent reasons that I'd read on the internet and things like that. But studying this section of Acts has persuaded me that there's a better strategy for defending the gospel.
Did you used to go around in a dog collar or anything at school?
I didn't go quite that far, no. But I was probably a little bit obnoxious.
George, like we've said, we're here today to talk about the sermon you preached on Acts chapter 19, verse 21 to 41. It is the story of the riot in Ephesus. I guess in the Book of Acts, it's probably one of the more well-known stories. And I've listened to your sermon a couple of times. It was really, really fantastic. And you were saying that Luke, the author of Acts, his point in the sermon was to give an insight into the opposition of the gospel. And I think you were saying the opposition, it has vested interests. It's got a kind of financial motive. It's often swept up in mass hysteria, but it's also, your words were, sent packing by due process. Is that a kind of fair representation of what the sermon was about?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was going for.
George, I remember in the talk, you started with, well, really quite a long introduction in which you talked about the section of the Book of Acts that this passage was in. Why did you make such a big deal about that?
I think you've already hit the nail on the head in that this is a great story. There's lots of dramatic action. But what do you actually do with it as a sermon? How do you preach it? At what points do you draw out of that story and apply to the Christian today? And as I was working on this text, it struck me that its position within the book of Acts is what gives you the preachable material, the points to actually draw out and apply to us today. So I think I spoke a bit in the sermon about how there are different summary statements within the book of Acts that divide the material up into different panels. And you get one of those key summary statements just before this passage in Acts chapter 19, verse 20. And this is a verse that we mentioned quite a few times as we went through the series in Acts.
What is the verse, sorry?
So that's Acts 19, 20, where Luke reports, after Paul's ministry in Ephesus, the word of the Lord continued to increase and prevail mightily. And he's wanting you to think there of an advancing, conquering army. The word of God, like a conquering army, goes forward and divides its enemies and prevails over them. And that verse really governs the whole of the previous section. And then the riot at Ephesus starts off a new section in the book of Acts that takes you right up to the end of the book, where instead of seeing the gospel prevail mightily, you see Paul much more on the defensive. Most of the section, he's on trial before various public officials, and he's having to give an account for his ministry and defend it before them. In other words, he's defending the public credibility of Christianity. Does Christianity stand up in the public square when it's put to the test before the highest court?
A bit like you in secondary school.
Yeah.
Wearing your little dog collar as the reverend.
A bit like me, but a much more exalted situation, a much more important context, because this isn't just sort of a school sixth form. This is as high as it goes, as serious as it gets, before serious public officials. Will the gospel stand up there as well?
William, Tim, do you guys agree on this kind of structure?
I thought it was one of the things that I found most helpful about what George said, both when he was talking about it before the Sunday when you preached, when you were telling us what you were planning to say, and on the night when you preached. To set it in that context made so much more sense of the details that Luke writes. I think when we try and split Acts merely geographically and put this with the passage before and lose that section that Luke's put it in, it becomes much harder to know what to do with the kind of absurdity of it and quite how to process the details. I found it really helpful when you just drew our attention to what was coming and said, and so this is how he's setting this section up.
Tim, can you just clarify what you mean, the geographical split? How is this different?
Well, in the sense that Acts 19, the whole chapter is in Ephesus and Paul spends years there. We find out in Acts 19, verse 10, that he continued for 2 years in this location. So you might think, oh, we should just hold the whole thing as time in Ephesus and have your sermon series either finish at the end of chapter 19 or perhaps start at the beginning of chapter 19. But because Luke has written his big section marker in the middle of the chapter, and we want to preach the way the author would want us to preach, we want to put our break there and go, here's a new chunk of material.
I think it's worth remembering those section markers. They come in chapter 6, verse 7, chapter 9, verse 31, chapter 12, verse 24, chapter 16, verse 5, and chapter 19, verse 20. And Luke notes that the word grew, the church grew, the word grew, the church grew, the word grew. And those, I think, map very helpfully onto chapter 1, verse 8. You would be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. Obviously, that the last two or three take the gospel out to the ends of the earth.
So let me just get this straight, what we've been saying. So I think the three of you actually agree on this idea that Luke has structured his material and he seems to have structured it with these kind of markers throughout the text. And William, you were just saying that they're all to do with growth and it's all about how something is growing. Can I just push back a little bit? I'm not at all really an expert in Acts, but I guess my instinct is to feel, would it be easy to miss those markers? And actually, you know, it kind of feels like being in Ephesus, that should all be one section. Can you really convince me that actually this is correct?
I can talk a bit about the section that I was preaching on. And I think it's worth saying that those markers are hard to miss. And I don't think you would miss them as you were reading through Acts carefully, because they come up with almost exactly the same wording again and again and again. And most of the commentators that you will find on Acts will note them and observe them, but they just won't do very much with them. Mm. And so I've got here Alan Thompson's book, The Acts of the Risen Lord Jesus, a really helpful book. If you're looking for sort of one book that you'd buy to read on Acts, this would be a great one to get. But he, in the first chapter, talks about these structural markers. And then he changes tack and says, however, it's unlikely that Acts 19:20, which is that key structural verse, should be taken as a major literary break in Acts 19. It's better to see this as a statement concerning the power of the word in the midst of the wider narrative focus on Ephesus. So that's him doing the geographical grouping that Tim was speaking about a minute ago. And so overriding, noting the structural marker, but not particularly doing very much with it.
So you're saying that actually everyone does notice these. It's not as if we've discovered something new in Acts, but I guess you're saying that you've perhaps utilized them a little bit more or added a bit more emphasis and significance to them.
That's a very, very helpful way of putting it, Leo. I think I would be nervous if we were running simply with those phrases as our markers, as I am in Luke's gospel, in the second half of Luke's gospel. You wouldn't run just on the phrases. You have to put what you observe in the text in terms of repeated language and what appear to be markers alongside content. And in every other section of Acts, the content hangs together. So the content from chapter 6, verse 6 through to chapter 9 and the break in chapter 9, verse 20 or 30, it hangs together. So it's not just, you know, if we were hanging our hat just on these repeated phrases, I think, you know, we might feel a little bit nervous.
If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it may well be a section of Acts. That's what you're saying.
Yes, in slightly different words. David Gooding was the most magnificent Bible teacher and fascinating historian. He took us to the Biotapestry and he said, the way writers used to write back in the day was by having panel markers, he called them. That's how ancient historical writers wrote. And if you go, and I remember going out when I was, you know, once went to Normandy, we went to look at the Biotapestry purely because I wanted to have a sermon illustration or something like that. Don't tell anybody who was with me that.
Did you expense it to the church?
I didn't. But you can see it. And there are these panel markers at each point. So they didn't have chapters. They didn't have verse numbers. And the way the ancient writer, you see it at the beginning of Genesis, these are the generations of. So I think, you know, this is not some eccentric thing that is going on with certain individuals who've had particular training in this, that, or the other. This is just normally understood, and you see it in Acts and Luke.
And it's easy for that sort of thing to become very academic, and we're making sure all the section markers are in the right place. But the thing I was particularly struck by was how much that lifted what you preached, George, because it meant that all of the application felt incredibly contemporary, incredibly relevant to us as a congregation, but really persuasively what Luke, inspired by the Holy Spirit, was giving to us here because it was set in that context.
And can I just push you on that, or can I just ask you to expand on that? Because I'd love to know how this view of the section did actually determine how you preached this passage, George.
And that's why it matters so much. So we talked a bit earlier about how it's a great story, but what's it actually doing there? But if it's the start, the opening piece, as it were, in a whole section that's actually about the public credibility of the gospel, does Christianity stand up in the public square? Then it makes a lot of sense as the opening piece, because what it shows you is the opposition that Christianity has to be defended against. And actually, if that opposition were rational, calm, measured, then that would be one thing. But as it is, what Luke shows you ingeniously through this narrative is that the opposition to Christianity is often motivated by slightly dodgy reasons and characterized by a mob mentality that's whipped up into hysteria. And actually, the first public official in the story who pays the slightest bit of attention to due process and what should be happening, he dismisses the whole crowd and the whole thing's over and the gospel is publicly vindicated.
So William and Tim, how did this understanding of this section and how it's working shape how you interpreted the passages that you preached on?
I'd love to just touch on chapter 19, verse 20. The word of the Lord continued to increase and prevail mightily, or the King James, so mightily advanced the word of the Lord and prevailed. I preached leading into this section, but the fact that that summary statement is different to the two previous occasions where the word of the Lord multiplies. Here we have it prevails, and it prevails mightily. That's new. So that very substantially influenced the way I treated each of the sermons, because here is Luke using his standard, the word multiplies, the word advances, but giving it a different hue, a different taste. And so when I came to preach my passages, I emphasized much more strongly the prevailing mightily of the word.
I think the section so obviously has Paul on trial the whole way through, and it's striking that it begins with this kind of defense. And then you get Paul in front of the courts saying, here are the reasons why you shouldn't have me here, and I'm actually innocent before you. And to have so many trials feels like such an odd section. I guess it's one of the reasons why this part of Acts gets preached so infrequently. Until you realize that's a necessary step for Luke to take, and therefore it needs this extended discussion that begins with that kind of narrative and then progresses into these court scenes.
It's funny you say that, because I think likewise, I've always found these chapters kind of boring. Maybe not boring, but quite difficult. I know, shocking. But actually, you know, defending the gospel, hey, that's quite exciting. I'm all up for that. And actually having that frame on it, it does make me want to go back and be like, oh yeah, okay, so how is Paul under pressure here? How is Paul on trial? And you kind of understand the stakes a little bit better.
I think, like you, Leo, I had often read this section, not heard it preached very often, and usually thought, that's a great story, but what do I actually do with that? And what really helped me about seeing that this is how it functions within the section, that it's showing you what the opposition is like, really, that the gospel faces, just brought it to life and brought the whole section to life. Because suddenly it made me realize, no, this is our world. And actually Luke is a genius who understands what the world is like and what the opposition to Christianity is like. And so you read the passage and you think, actually, you see that all the time in our world today, where there are anti-Christian messages or things that make you feel uncomfortable as a Christian because they make you feel like you're out of step with the world around you. And then you dig a little bit deeper, and just like Demetrius and the silversmiths in Ephesus, it's all motivated by money. Or you see the way that the crowd are stirred up and whipped up into this frenzy in the middle of the passage. And then you think, yeah, that's our world actually, isn't it? You go and look on Twitter or on social media and you see the comment pile-ons where people are just jumping on the gospel, but how much do they actually know about the Christianity that they're attacking? So one of the one of our, my colleagues on the 6 p.m. congregation staff team, as we were chatting about this, that she helps with the walk-up evangelism here at St. Helens. And we got chatting about this and she said, yeah, that's every single person that I talk to at walk-up evangelism. You ask them first about Christianity and they tend to give you something fairly negative, hostile. You know, they think it's bigoted or backwards or unnecessary and outdated. And then you ask them a couple of follow-ups and you start to realize they don't actually really know what Christianity is. And that's exactly what you see in the middle of the riot in Ephesus. You know, the people were so passionate in their opposition, but Luke says they didn't really even know why they were there. So I think just bringing the passage into the 21st century brought it to life for me.
I think this is a really important discussion. For me, suddenly really coming to terms with the fact, I was at university at the time, that the gospel was defensible publicly, and publicly defensible as it stood as truth, that trumped all other truth around it and could actually pick holes in the kind of truths that people believe and be shown to triumph mightily. Now, that changes everything for the Christian as they leave church and go out amongst their non-Christian workplace colleagues, school, PR department, HR department, and all the rest of it, because we have confidence that the gospel is not just my own little personal existentialist truth. It is true truth, and it stands, and it can stand firm on its own terms.
I'd love to ask William, first of all, you're the rector, you're the senior pastor. Why have you chosen to have different preachers, other preachers, share the teaching and share the teaching series within your church?
Thank you. I don't think there's an absolute about this. I think I'd want to go to somewhere like Acts 13 and the way you see a team of speakers sharing in the ministry of the word. I think we sometimes assume that Paul must have been the kind of the A team. It never says that anywhere. And we always say they sent their best man. Doesn't say he was their best man. So, I mean, he was pretty good, obviously. but I'm a great believer that we should have a team of Bible teachers. I think on a kind of pragmatic level, you'll notice, as you do, that some people relate more to one person's style of teaching than another's. And so it's helpful to have different voices. It I think, cuts against the kind of top dog, you know, it's my church sort of syndrome, which I think is so ugly. And I think if you have several congregations like we do at St. Helens, you could say, as I've heard some people say, I am the A team and therefore I preach at every service. That limits the potential for growth and the potential ultimately to plant churches with those leading them whom the people trust. And I have always sought not to make, not, I mean, if I was on every week, the church would be empty anyway, but I've always sought not to have myself as the main voice, but to share the, it does mean that when a person arrives new, it takes a little while for the congregation to get used to them. And sometimes you'll, you know, people will be saying, oh goodness, what on earth's going on? You know, and somebody's learning to preach. So it takes several years to learn to preach to a particular congregation. But what I love seeing is those who have been trained, suddenly people would much rather they were on than I was on. And I mean, that's a rather silly way of putting it, but it is, does happen like that. And I think that's really healthy. It means you actually are able to bring in people to lead alongside you who are better than you ultimately. And then when they go off and plant a church, well, that's wonderful because everybody wants to go with them. So there are all sorts of upsides to it.
And even if you're in a setting where you don't have lots of staff, but you're getting elders from the congregation to support you in the preaching, I think it's quite it's so useful for the congregation to see this isn't just what the pastor thinks And this line that we're taking through Acts isn't just what one of us thought, but actually you hear different voices saying what God is saying in this passage, and all of them together helping you to see that that's what this this section's about.
And just to speak from experience, what I've found so helpful about working with other preachers on this series in Acts has been the fact that it's been collaborative. So it can end up as a bit of a disaster if you have multiple preachers within the same series, because you'll get 3 weeks of one particular line down the section, and then the second preacher will get up and almost subtly refute everything that the congregation have heard the last 3 weeks and give their particular direction. And then it happens again whenever the next preacher gets up. And what I've appreciated about doing Acts together in this group has been that we have a service planning meeting before each talk, early enough in the preparation process that it can actually change the direction that you're going in. And you're having that discussion not just with other randomly selected other people, but with other preachers who've been working on the same section, and who can, that they can then bring in their own thoughts, and you can actually sharpen each other and get further.
Can you tell us a bit more about that? What does it look like, those service planning meetings?
Yeah, so usually the person who's preaching will come having done the most work, and they'll usually start by giving a bit of a presentation about where they've got to in their thinking, what they think the big thrust of the passage is, where they think the main lines of application might be drawn.
And who's there, sorry, at these service planning meetings? Is it just the preachers?
No, not just the preachers. So it would be everyone who's preaching within the series, but also other members of the staff team who are working within that congregation, who might have helpful things to chip in and to add.
And it's worth saying we have a range of different people who do give different voices and have different experience of the different congregation members. And I always find it so helpful to hear the different things that they say, and often come with questions for them.
Yeah. So one of the things that happened when we were preparing for this series was that we had a service planning meeting. I think it was for one of my sermons. And I explained my thoughts on the public defensibility of the gospel. That was the thrust of the whole section. And one of the people in the room who'd been a bit quiet in the meeting was asked for their thoughts. And he said, well, actually, I'm not sure that's what this section of Acts is about. And, you know, we then had a really helpful discussion about how to make both of our thinking a bit sharper. And that's how we ended up landing where we landed.
It's a very good meeting. And I think you could do this in any setting. It doesn't have to be. But we have our women's workers are in the meeting. They give a very helpful perspective. You know, how might that land? We try and make sure that the preacher comes with his next 4 weeks worth, with the main thrust of each talk. And, you know, ideally, and it's always the first one or two are slightly sharper than the second, number three and number four, but the main thrust of each talk. And then the musos can plan well, but it means that the preacher has to get on with it and be well ahead, and that's good for them.
Can I just ask you three a little bit more about the service planning specifically for this series in Acts? George, you've already talked a bit about it and the objectives, but as you kind of came with your views on Acts 19 and your following passages, what kind of discussion were you having? What did it look like? I'd love to know what kind of things you were discussing as you looked at the final 10 chapters of Acts or so.
One of the big things that we talked about, anyone who's listened to some of the Acts series that we did, you'll have noticed that the passages were quite big. And that's one of the challenges of preaching this part of Acts, is either you go on for weeks and weeks and weeks, or you take quite big sections at a time. And so one of the things that we talked about quite a lot was, as the preacher gave their presentation and talked us through, is that actually what the text is saying? And how do you get that balance right between actually getting people into the text and, on the other hand, showing them enough of the wider context and the bigger story and themes of Acts that they see it situated within that overarching narrative?
And we were trying to think, when you have to split it the way that you think the author would split it. You can't just arbitrarily pick the next 20 verses. You've got to go, what are the chunks that Luke's written this in? And so the different trial scenes made sense, but often made very long passages. And then you've got to think, well, here's a congregation who hopefully will have read ahead and would have read before they got there, but we want to be realistic about it and say, well, how can we help them into the text? Is there a base verse or a place that you can root the sermon that does a lot of the heavy lifting and teaches the rest of the chapter? Which again, we were trying to do when we came to service planning, but that's quite tricky because Luke didn't write two verses. He wrote two chapters for this section. And that was a really useful time, I think, for all of us to actually explore that together and think about it.
Okay. Mm.
Can I ask, have you ever all disagreed?
Well, I came to a service planning in this series with completely the wrong idea and everybody disagreed with me and really helped me. It was great.
And you were willing to change your mind?
I think you've got to have done enough work in the text that I hope nobody would instantly change their mind. Mm. But I think the discussion isn't just, well, for me, this means this. It's a discussion with the Bible open and exploring the text and prayerfully, you ask the Lord's help. And actually, when God's people gather around his word, his spirit is there and he helps us to make progress. And it was actually really useful for me. It was very humbling. It was really useful for me to go, actually, yeah, there is something more this is saying. And I think it actually really helped to make it a better sermon.
We do something very similar with Bible studies, don't we? If we are co-leading with somebody, we try and send them our study ahead of time to say, this is where I've got to. This is where I still have questions. What do you think? I guess you're kind of replicating that in service planning for the congregation.
I usually send my Bible study about 10 minutes before the study starts, to be honest with you. We've talked about the value of planning a service together. I guess there must be a lot of value in retrospectively looking at the sermons we've preached together. I presume that amongst you, you give each other feedback for the sermons you've preached. I was just wondering, Tim and William, did you give any feedback to George for this sermon? And if you did, what kind of points did you raise?
Well, I've got to tell you, I mean, I got feedback in no uncertain terms this morning for the sermon I preached last night from Tiff. She told me she couldn't make head or tail of what I was saying in the first 5 minutes of the talk.
Someone had to say it.
People are very free with their feedback. It's one of the lovely things about the team at St. Annan's is I would like to feel that we're not overly precious. I mean, I believe that once the sermon is preached, it is public property. It is for the church to weigh. And so I think feedback is really important. And we actually do it as a staff team. So we will assemble everybody together once a month or so, and we will listen to one of the preacher's last talks. And I'll ask a couple of people to listen to it a second time. We'll all listen to it. So we will all listen to it twice. The people who are going to give feedback will have listened to it three times. And then we have a public discussion about the talk. And it's done, you know, lovingly, graciously. It's, you know, we always start with one of mine at the beginning of the year, and people that I always feel slightly robust in their critique. But it's very healthy because it shows the preacher, you know, not they can't be precious about it. And the authority is in the word of God, not in the individual. So it's very important, I think.
So what kind of feedback did you give to George from this sermon?
So I remember chatting to you at some point in the week afterwards, just because there was so much that I was really encouraged by. And I think because it was one of the first sermons that you'd preached at the 6 p.m, we reflected a bit that the intro was quite long. I think you said earlier how helpful it was to have lots of this section set up. But having done so much brilliant work in the study, trying to work out how much to bring into the actual talk, I think there's probably about 10 minutes of introduction and taking out the structure of this chapter because it wasn't quite needed in order to make the point that you did. It was all true. It was all, I thought, compelling and helpful, but I didn't think it was necessary for what you went on to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, my feedback, I had two pieces of feedback, and one of them was I just thought it was really excellent. And the reason I thought I really found it helpful is I'd always believed strongly that this was part of the second, that part of the whole section running right through chapter 28. And we talked about that a bit, but George showed us very clearly from the text, and it was the way we found the center of the piece and saw that this really is what the text is saying, that it's part of the public defensibility of the gospel. So I was really delighted, and I thought it was just such a helpful talk in terms of our own confidence in standing with the gospel. So I think that was my main feedback, wasn't it?
The other thing that came up a few weeks later was a student who's new to St. Helens and really used to the Bible being taught, but who was very used to Jesus being very obviously front and center in every talk. And I guess one of the things about this section of Acts is that Paul is right at the center of all the action. And I think re-listening to your talk, of course you mentioned Jesus, you mentioned the gospel a lot. And I just wonder if sometimes our shorthand can let Jesus slip off center stage, and actually helping a congregation to realize that as we talk about Paul and the gospel and its defensibility, this is about our Lord Jesus and how we stand with him and the work he is doing in the world. And I wondered if you might have been able to bring more of that out.
One of the things that I think service planning models really well is that even as the preacher, having done so much work on the text, you are still learning, and there are still things about the text that you don't understand that you need others to help you with. And that's interesting, Tim, that you mentioned about, where would you talk about Jesus in this passage? And I think that's something that I'm still wrestling with, because as a preacher, you want every sermon to be a Christian sermon. And so you want to have Jesus front and center, but you also don't want to shoehorn him in an unnatural way, or in a way that the author doesn't intend. And so quite how Luke is doing that in this passage is something I'm still wrestling with.
In your sermon, George, you talked about the defensibility of the gospel. And we've been saying that really is the main idea, the main theme, the backbone of these final chapters in the book of Acts. And I'd love to just talk a bit more about this idea of the gospel's defensibility. I guess all Christians are interested in defending the gospel. But in my own experience, to do that, I don't really, or haven't really in the past, turned to the Bible that much. It doesn't weirdly seem like the number one place to go. Could you convince me that these chapters in Acts really are a good place to start and a good place to turn to?
Yeah, we talk a lot about apologetics, which means giving different reasons to defend Christianity, and it often involves coming up with various different answers, convincing answers, persuasive answers to the common questions that non-Christians might ask. And it tends to be fairly philosophical, rational, engaging with those questions and arguments. Quite like what I guess I was doing when I was a sixth former in my school sixth form, debating with my atheist friends about whether Christianity stood up. And what I think is interesting, what I've come to be persuaded of, is that the Bible has an apologetic of its own. Huh. So apologia is the Greek word for defense. And as Luke lays out this last section of Acts, he is giving an apology, a defense of Christianity. But what distinguishes it from what we often call apologetics, and what challenged me, was both who I think Luke primarily addresses and also the way that he goes about defending the gospel. So firstly, who he addresses. In apologetics, the way that we do it, that's often something between, say, a Christian and someone who's not a Christian. But Luke, I think, primarily addresses his apology, his defense, to the Christian, in order to give the Christian confidence in the gospel so that they can stand in the public square. And then secondly, there's the way that he goes about it. So I think Luke, rather than giving a long series of question and answer, instead he tells the Christian story, and he shows you how in the story of, first the story of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke, and then in the story of the early church and the advance of the gospel to the end of the earth, God's purposes and everything that he promised would happen in the Old Testament has been fulfilled and come to pass. So one of the most helpful things that I read on the passage of Acts that I preached on in the riot in Ephesus was an article called Riot and Assembly by Robert F. Stoops. And he finishes the article by reflecting a bit on Luke's literary strategy. And he says, literary apologetics serves multiple purposes. Convincing relevant authorities and hostile outsiders is important, but it may be more important to show those who are under attack that their position is defensible.
So almost you're saying apologetics is not necessarily primarily for bringing the unbeliever in, but keeping the believer going.
Yes, in lots of ways. And the way that Luke goes about doing that is not by giving you a long list of Q&A, but telling the Christian story. So Stoops also says, Acts is not a handbook of debating points, but a presentation of Luke's understanding of the world and the place of the community of believers within that world.
You wouldn't want to be absolutist about that, I guess. But what's so striking is that Luke, who is so often understood to be the great gospel writer for the Gentiles, uses the Old Testament so much, and I would argue so does the Apostle Paul in Athens, both as he preaches in the marketplace and then in, if you what you might call the follow-up meeting, the Areopagus. It's absolutely loaded with the Old Testament. So I think the apologetic stool of biblical apologetics, I think, has three legs to it. First, the works of the Lord Jesus, and then his word, and then the witness, both of the Old Testament and of the eyewitnesses to Jesus, the apostles. I hope that doesn't make four legs.
I was going to say, that sounds like four legs.
No, it's not four legs. It's three legs, but one with two splints to it. But I think it's really very, I mean, joking aside, I think it's really very important, because what we do if we say, well, you've got to be an expert in cosmology, or you've got to be an expert in, 20th century philosophy, what we do is we de-skill the believer from being able to speak openly and clearly of the Lord Jesus with courage and certainty.
I think we often look to the most intellectual people, the professors or the ones who know Hebrew and ancient Greek. We look to them to defend Christianity. Do these chapters say anything in relation to that?
Yeah, I don't think any of that is to say that apologetics doesn't have its place. It can be really helpful to have an expert presentation on a particular issue, and we do that sometimes at St. Helens when there's a particular question that the friends of those in the congregation are thinking about. We'll have an event that addresses that question, and the speaker will be someone who's particularly qualified to do so. But what the biblical apologetic and what Luke's apologetic in this last section of Acts does is it gives a defense that every Christian can make, and one that is particularly aimed at giving them the confidence to stand themselves, one that equips them as well as helping them to answer their friends' questions. And I think that means that Luke brings in some things that we wouldn't naturally, or we wouldn't often go to. So one of those would be, look at the importance of the Old Testament narrative and the way that it's fulfilled in the story of the New Testament. And I think we underestimate how persuasive that can be. So this last term, I've been reading the Bible with a non-Christian. The other week we read John chapter 2, so the story of the wedding at Cana. And we had a look at Isaiah 25 and the way that Jesus fulfills those prophecies of a bridegroom who will be God himself, who will swallow up death and provide this feast of rich food and well-aged wine. And you could see as the penny dropped in his mind, this is amazing, that prophecies that were spoken 900, 800, 700 years before Jesus were fulfilled in him. that was someone who'd never really engaged with Christianity before. And that argument cut to the heart much more than if we'd spent the evening arguing over philosophical questions.
I guess a question to all three of you is, how has studying these chapters and passages helped you?
I found it really helpful to come off the back of this series when it then came to carol services and thinking, what is it that I'm going to say to these people? I had friends arriving at the carol service.
So this is non-believers coming to Christmassy.
Yeah, and coming basically because they're friends and they know that I'm speaking and because it's Christmassy and they like the feels of Christmas and thinking, I am about to tell you something that, you know, I've tried to communicate to you before, but which I hope will be really clearly telling you, you are in need of salvation, that you are under God's judgment and need to be saved. And to have this kind of section to embolden all of us about this gospel was a really helpful place to have been just before the carol service, and to be persuaded not just that it's the right thing to do, but that it is a good thing to do that can stand up in that public square and can work and rescue people, and to think that God is behind that, that God is advancing this.
You know, I found almost the exact same thing. One of the companies around here, one of the banks, had a Christmas service which I had the privilege to go and speak at. And that morning I thought, if I go and deliver a talk from which everyone goes away feeling warm and fuzzy, I think I've probably failed and at that opportunity. But when I got there and you stand in the middle of, you know, this bank's world headquarters to an atrium of people, it is quite a scary thing. But actually, just to think, and I did think, this is how Christian preaching has always been, was really tremendously helpful.
And none of that is to undermine, it is brilliant news. We don't want to make it sound like we've got something that isn't defensible. It is good news for the whole world. But I think because we're so prone to find ourselves feeling anxious or uneasy, it is good for us to be able to know this section of Acts and all that it tells us.
And as, I mean, you know, I would wholeheartedly endorse all of that. That's absolutely key. People listening around the world may not be aware of the sort of things going on in the Church of England at the moment, but, you know, we've faced some fairly turbulent times. And I think a lot of church leaders forget that most people in the workplace have to face the sort of things that are going on in terms of defending the gospel in churches every day of their working life. And the kids who are standing up for the gospel in our schools and leading their Christian unions are facing this every day. So there's nothing special about us and the sort of battles that we're facing. But when you face those battles, isn't it wonderful to have this sort of publicly defensible gospel that you know you're arguing for? And then it helps you actually to exposit, if you like, the response of those who stand against it.
Yeah, this is helpful for any Christian, whether they're leading a church or whether they go to church once a week. Mm. George, just a question to close. If you were to preach this passage again, what would you change?
Well, I'd definitely make the introduction a bit shorter.
And mention Jesus.
Yeah, that's right. I think one of the things I've also thought about is, how do you come across, how do you capture the tone of the passage whilst also not coming across as a slightly grumpy old man who just doesn't like certain aspects of culture,
without becoming the sixth form reverend again?
Yeah. And particularly, I think what we want to be careful is, we don't want to sound like Christianity lines up on one side of the culture wars. And I think I talked a bit about, you know, some of the aspects of our culture that are more hysterical and mob mentality. And that can often be associated with, I think, a certain political outlook. And I think there's a danger that you come across as sounding just grumpy about cultural decline. And I think that's a danger in all preaching, whenever we're talking about secularism or about the growing disillusionment with religion and with Christianity in our culture. There's a danger that we sound like we're saying, we just wish it were the 1950s again. And I think perhaps I veered slightly too close to that, in particular in some of the stuff in the middle of the talk, and just wanting to be especially careful to say that's not what Luke is saying, and therefore that's not what we're saying, but keeping that positive focus on this is why the gospel stands up, this is why you can be confident, this is why you don't need to be intimidated.
It was nonetheless a really excellent talk. Thank you so much for working on it, George, and thank you so much for coming here to speak to us today.
And thank you, William and Tim, for joining us too. It's been great to hear from you.
Lovely to be here again.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Bible Matters podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, why not like and subscribe on whatever platform you get your podcasts? The Bible Matters project is funded entirely by the generous gifts of our listeners. And if you yourself would like to become a financial partner with us, you can find more details on how to give in the show notes. The Bible Matters podcast is an initiative of St. Helens Bishopsgate and is created by myself, Tiff Stromso, along with Leo Elborn. Music for this episode was written and produced by Leo Elborn and Josh Stidwell. You can listen to more of Josh's work at Stids with a one, that is ST1DS. Thanks again for joining, and we hope to see you again soon.